Our next speaker is Dr. Tina St. Pierre, Associate Professor of Agricultural and Extension Education at the Pennsylvania State University. She is also a Senior Research Associate at Penn State's Institute for Policy Research and Evaluation, where she has been conducting field-based research on the prevention of substance abuse and other problem behaviors among high-risk youth and their families since 1987. Over the past decade, Dr. St. Pierre has been awarded 3 large research grants from the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. 2 of her programs, about which she will talk today, have been identified by the center to be part of its upcoming national dissemination of most effective programs. Only 7 programs in the U.S. have been so identified. Dr. St. Pierre directs 2 of the 7. Her current research concerns the implementation and evaluation of a multi-site, collaborative, community-based prevention program for elementary school children and their families. It involves boys and girls clubs, parents, and schools together. Several articles of her work have been published in scholarly journals. She also teaches graduate and undergraduate classes at the State University. You know, I first bumped into Dr. St. Pierre's work some years ago when she published an article, it might have been her first published paper, I'm not sure, on job stress among extension agents. When I shared the findings with county extension agents here in this state, they were very pleased to see how stressed they were, especially the 4-H agents, who tend to have meetings most nights of every week and had the very worst stress scores in the whole study. Those 4-H agents wore your findings like a badge of courage, proud of the miserableness you had so ably measured. I do not doubt that Dr. St. Pierre could perform the same service for many of us in this room today. All right. Dr. St. Pierre.
Good morning, and I want to tell you that it's a pleasure to be here today and to speak to so many people interested in youth resiliency. This is a very important topic, and it makes me feel very good that so many people share the interest in that topic. I've been interested in youth for many, many years, and through the research that I've conducted over the last 11 years, I've become more and more determined to find ways that we can build resiliency and reduce risk in adolescents and youth, and especially high-risk populations. My presentation today is based on a 5-year study funded by the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention. I have a very able assistant, by the way. Her name is Ann, and I've been told she does a wonderful job with transparencies. So far, she's doing really well, Ann. The study took place in 16 boys and girls clubs in 8 different states, and what I'm going to do this morning is I'm going to describe our high-risk population, which, by the way, we define as being economically disadvantaged. I'm going to describe briefly what the program is about and the study's results, and then I'm going to go into the policy implications. It's well documented that involving economic disadvantaged parents in programs is very, very difficult. And I think you can see why by these statistics. Our families lived in severely distressed neighborhoods. In fact, these are the criteria that the Annie E. Casey Foundation has used to describe severely distressed neighborhoods. You can see 34% of them were living below the poverty level. 44% of them were female-headed households. And 20% were public assistance recipients. What we found was our families were living daily lives of high stress. They basically were careening from crisis to crisis. They were accustomed to proving their failures on a daily basis in order to secure services. And their lives were filled with helplessness and hopelessness. And you can also see by this next transparency that our families lived in high-risk neighborhoods. These were answers that our youth gave on the last questionnaire that we administered, and we asked them about their views on neighborhood drug activity. And as you can see, 58% of them felt that many or most people in their neighborhood were using illegal drugs. 61% said they had seen illegal drugs sold in their neighborhoods, and 78% said that they had been offered illegal drugs. Now, these kids were 11 and a half years old when they started the study, and so this was 3 years later. So you can get a sense of how high risk our population was. This next slide shows you the program that we implemented. And I want to add, by the way, that our program, our whole study was based on the risk factor, protective factor approach that Karen earlier described. And it was based on a needs assessment in the communities, and that's how we developed our approach and the program that we implemented. You can see by this that it was a two-part program. There was the Smart Moves Youth Prevention Program, and as I said, these kids were about 11 and a half when they started the program. Over 3 years, as you can see, the first year was a program called Start Smart, the second year was a program called Stay Smart, and the third year was a program called Smart Leaders. And the children, basically what they did is it was a longitudinal study, so they started out in Start Smart and they went through the three consecutive programs. At the same time, we had a companion program called the Family Advocacy Network, and we called that the FAN Club for short, because that was the acronym. And what it was is basically the same time the kids were in the prevention program, the adults were in the Family Advocacy Network FAN Club Parent Involvement Program. Now, this basically was designed to meet parents' needs. It was an empowerment approach. It was designed to strengthen families and addressed many of the risk factors and the protective factors that Karen talked about this morning. The same with the youth prevention program. It focused on developing social skills. It was a social influence model, so it was designed to help the youth identify the pressures on them to use alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs, and ways to resist those pressures. So I won't spend a lot of time talking about the program because I know that we need to get on with the policy implications. I will say the next slide that I'm going to be showing you is showing you the results that we had. I'm only going to show you two because they are indicative of a pattern. What we did is we pre-tested the kids before they went through the youth prevention program, and then we post-tested them at six different times. You can put it up. After that. And we found a pattern of positive results. The positive results were for the prevention program and the youth prevention program and the parent involvement program. That group is in blue. I'll call those the FAN Club group. And what you can see, the way this graph is, well, we had a match comparison group, which was the control group, and that's the line in red. And what we found over time is, this is fun, Karen. You can see at the first post-test, the control group was showing a greater ability to refuse alcohol. So the higher score meant less ability to refuse. So as you can see over time, over the 3 years, which actually was 35-month post-test was here, that the control group became less able to refuse alcohol. And the FAN Club group, who actually started out at the beginning as being less able, became more able to refuse. So we felt that that was pretty good evidence that the program was working. The next one. I have another slide here that also shows you the same pattern, and this was on the perceived ability to refuse marijuana. By the way, we asked them how well would you be able to refuse marijuana if a friend offered it to you, same way with alcohol. And we have the same kind of pattern. You can see here the FAN Club group started out with less ability to refuse, and over time they became more able to refuse. The control group started out with greater ability to refuse and became less able to refuse. Now, we had these same patterns for cigarette refusal, similar patterns for cigarette refusal. We also had similar patterns for attitudes towards using marijuana, whereas the FAN Club group became more negative, perceived more negative attitudes towards the benefits of using marijuana. We also found similar results in terms of knowledge of the social and health consequences of using alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. Okay, in terms of the policy implications of this, I believe that our study strongly suggests that parent involvement may help prevent future drug use by high-risk youth and that nonprofit youth organizations are able to involve high-risk parents in prevention programs. I think this is really an important fact, and I think there is an unbelievable opportunity out there for nonprofit youth organizations to engage youth in prevention programs and to engage their parents in this kind of a parent involvement program. It's very, very difficult to do, and I believe that these youth organizations have the characteristics necessary to do so. Now, why is this? First of all, what we found was it's not only just Boys and Girls Clubs. I think that there are many youth organizations that have these characteristics. I believe that there are churches could do the same thing. 4-H groups could do the same thing. Scouts, YWCAs, YMCAs. So it's not just only Boys and Girls Clubs, but the particular study that we did involved Boys and Girls Clubs. And what we found that they were conducive to reaching parents, first of all, because of their positive reputations. The parents are receptive to these Boys and Girls Clubs because they lived in these unsafe neighborhoods and they saw the clubs as safe places for their kids and for themselves in often unsafe neighborhoods. They also found the Boys and Girls Clubs as non-threatening, having non-threatening atmospheres. Our parents were living in communities where they were having to deal with social service agencies, with the housing authority, with the juvenile justice system, and even the schools in a way that they found those organizations intimidating and threatening. When they came to the Boys and Girls Clubs, they didn't feel that. They felt welcome and they felt respected. And they were treated with respect. And I think that's one of the things about implementing this kind of a program in an organization where it can be tailored to the needs of the population and where there's a real desire to treat the parents with respect and make them welcome. The parents really have been used, in our study anyway, they were so beaten down by the experiences they had had in the community that they were almost surprised when they came to the Boys and Girls Clubs and people were respectful of them, they treated them as peers. And it took a while for them to even realize that people were sincere. But by doing this over this period of 3 years, they gradually began to develop trust. And this, I think, is why they started coming to the program. And they actually, over time, took over the program because the program was using an empowerment approach. And the goal of it was to strengthen families, empower them so that they could develop their own program activities and determine what they wanted and what they needed. And by doing so, I believe that it helped strengthen them to the point that they felt more competent and they were better able to help themselves and to be better parents. And the flexibility of the program in the Boys and Girls Club also was an asset because Karen talked about the value of home visits. And in our program, whenever the parents were intimidated, even yet with the Boys and Girls Clubs, this happened with some parents, especially in very stressful situations. The coordinator of the program would go out and visit the parent and would do home visits. In situations where the parent felt uncomfortable coming to the Boys and Girls Club for the parent program that was going on, because there were parenting skills also being taught, the coordinator would go to the parent's home or maybe take two or three other parents and they would have a small group session in the home. And many, many other agencies do not have this flexibility and this individualized approach. And by individualized approach, I'm talking about tailoring it to the needs of the parents. Too many programs today are offered with the agenda already pre-made. In this kind of a program, you can find out what the parents want, and then you can tailor the program to their needs, and they actually are the ones who determine what the activities are. And over time, they become more empowered, and they become feeling stronger, and their confidence grows, and they feel that they can do more, and then they end up being able to do more. And lastly, in terms of reaching parents, we found that having their children involved in a youth organization that they were very excited about, the kids liked being at the Boys and Girls Clubs, so therefore they prompted their parents to become involved. And of course, it helped a little bit that the coordinator of the program encouraged the kids to to prompt the parents to come. But that certainly was one of the major drawing cards. And of course, the reason that the children were coming to the Boys and Girls Clubs is because of the enticing youth activities that were going on. It was not like school, where kids often don't enjoy going to school, unfortunately. But by the social and recreational activities that were offered by the Boys and Girls Clubs, the kids wanted to come. So then the program coordinators could slip in the educational part, could do the prevention program, and the kids just took it all in stride and thought it was great because the adult leader made it fun for them. Also, the Boys and Girls Clubs and other youth organizations can provide positive adult role models. And this is another thing that Karen talked about in her presentation, the importance of an adult role model that takes a special interest in a child. That's a very important protective factor. And this was a critical aspect of this kind of program. And this could be done in any nonprofit youth organization. It's that matter that adult role model cares about the child and takes a special interest. The next thing has to do with flexibility. The prevention program can be offered in a youth organization very differently than it's offered in a school. What we found is sometimes the kids were just not up to having the program one night. Maybe some serious crime, some terrible thing had happened in their community. In one example, we had a youth who was living right next door to a murder that occurred just the night before, and it was the talk of the whole group of kids. So they canned the program that night and just talked about what happened and how it helped the kids deal with that. And at other times, the program would go on longer. The particular night they did the small group session, they could go for a couple hours if they wanted to. You can't do that in a school setting. So that flexibility is great. They also were able to do makeups of the sessions when kids missed because they could do it at another time because it was an informal atmosphere. We also found that they could do it in a fun way. One club was really very creative. They did a makeup with the kids by having what they called a lock-in, where they had the kids stay overnight, and they did makeups on the sessions. And the kids loved it. They got to play basketball, then they got to do some prevention small group sessions and went back to the swimming pool, and it really worked out very well. They locked them in for the night, but they thought it was great. And lastly, I think one very important part that these youth organizations can provide for kids, especially high-risk kids, is bonding. And we found some of the kids in our study who had not bonded well with school bonded very well with the program leaders and the other staff at the Boys and Girls Clubs. As a result, they ended up coming to the Boys and Girls Club, coming to the program, being receptive to the program because of the way they were treated. It wasn't like school. And so I believe what happened is it maximized exposure to prevention in many ways, not only just the youth program, but just that positive kind of interaction with that adult role model who often was a surrogate parent, especially since we had so many female-headed households. We had a lot of young men in this study who had no father figure, or the father was incarcerated or in drug rehab. So that was another important aspect. Okay. Lastly, I'd like to say, in summary, I really do believe that nonprofit youth organizations can play a prominent role in building resiliency and reducing risk in high-risk youth. I also believe that the state government can support these organizations in a number of ways, and I don't have a lot of time, but I want to briefly just go over it. And I think one thing that I thought of is that I think it would just be helpful for youth organizations and state government agencies just to get to learn about each other, just have opportunities to perhaps get together and learn about what each other is doing. Find out who they are. Sometimes there can be false images. For example, I know in Pennsylvania there's a false image that 4-H is cows, sows, and plows, and that's all it is, and primarily in rural areas, and that's not true. Prevention programs can be implemented through 4-H, and there are many, many 4-H groups that are located in urban areas. So there's an example. Ask the nonprofit youth organizations what state policies constrain their effectiveness. How can state government best serve their efforts? Can it be providing best practices? Can it be by providing pass-through funds in terms of block grants? Or can it be by being a partner in prevention efforts? For example, I quickly want to mention there's a new initiative by the Secretary of Health and Human Services to prevent substance abuse. And what's now out as an RFP that can be applied for through the governor's office in each state is called State Incentive Cooperative Agreements. And there are, I believe, $42 million available, and 12 to 18 grants are going to be awarded in fiscal year 98. And this is to be initiated through the governor's office, where the governor's office coordinates a statewide effort of how they're going to be addressing the prevention of a drug use in their state. If anybody's interested in knowing more about this, maybe some of you already know about it. I have the application booklet with me that I could show it to you later. But I do believe this is a new, a really great stride forward in terms of trying to develop statewide efforts and mobilizing existing efforts in communities across the state so that new services aren't developed that are duplicating one another, just mobilizing what's already there and doing this in a very coordinated, concerted effort. So thank you very much.
Questions for a few minutes. Yeah, what did this measure of refusal really mean? Did it reflect actual behavioral changes?
That's an excellent question. It's an excellent question, and I'm glad somebody asked it, because you're right. The best measure is how is behavior affected by these programs. We did not get behavioral change, and I believe one of the reasons for this is the fact that the kids were so young when we started. You know, they were 11.35 years of age, so, and they were conservative to begin with, and not, there wasn't a whole lot of time for them to really start using drugs in comparison to the control group. We did do a study prior to this where we started with 13-year-olds. In fact, that was in Boys and Girls Clubs as well, and if anybody's interested, I can send you the article on that, where we implemented almost the exact same program, and we did get behavior change with all these variables. But these kids were older, and in order to see real behavior change, you have to have a comparison group. Well, the kids have to be a little bit older, and the comparison group, of course, is the same age, and so the comparison group shows you what happens normally developmentally, over several years. So I believe we might have gotten behavior change had the kids been a little bit older.
First, there was a comment that settings are not the key feature. The key feature is the relationship with an adult, and a relationship requires smaller numbers of kids per adult, and adults really, really connecting. And the question is about how that can really happen anywhere. It can happen not just in a boys' or girls' club, but in a school. Why not use schools as the locus? Bring the clubs there in the after-school hours or whenever. Is that a possibility?
I agree with you that in the youth organization, whatever type it is, you have to have quality. So there are criteria that have to be adhered to in order for it to be a good program. And that also goes back to training and so forth. That's a very good point, so I agree with you on that. In terms of bringing the program to an after-school setting, I think that's possible to do, but I think it really depends on the relationship of the parents in the community to the school. And in our current study, which is the one that was talked about in the introduction for me, we are working with schools, and we've developed a team effort where we're working with Boys and Girls Clubs, parents, and schools. And what we are finding in that study is that it's taking a while to break down the barriers and the intimidation that has developed over the years between the parents in the neighborhood and the school. And it's a gradual process to develop positive relationships, and we're having to bring the parties along very, very slowly. And I think the danger of taking the program right into the school is that there hasn't been enough time to break down those barriers and start making positive relationships. Whereas if it started in the club atmosphere, there's already a positive feeling and a positive relationship. But I'm not saying it can't be done. I mean, I think it's certainly something worth pursuing. And I think the more organizations in the community you partner with, the better off you are, because then you develop that positive relationship with school, and you break down the barriers and reduce the threats. So it can be done, but in our population, it wasn't something we could just go right in and do.